You know, I am what you like to call fungus prone, which I think is rude, but also very true.
I don't remember saying that, but I don't deny that that is very like me.
I have psoriasis. So the weird thing is it travels, right? Now it's showing up in like circle patches on the middle of my kneecaps.
Weird.
I didn't know what it was. I thought I was like, man, I just kneel. I kneel a lot. Summer. The doctor was like, no. Good guess.
Thanks for playing.
Now, you guys are going to go look up psoriasis on the internet. And please, mine is cute psoriasis. That psoriasis, not cute.
Yeah, you know, we are known for cute knees, you and I. Nope.
We've got ugly knees.
I'm glad to have knees. I'm not trying to say I wish I didn't have knees.
You're not knocking knees. So anyway, it's a traveling circus that I have, and it's traveled to the inside of my ears.
What? Is
It
it still cute in
hurts.
there?
It's pretty cute though.
Hey friends, you are listening to the Mom Struggling Well podcast, the show that helps you love your actual life so you don't need to run away from home. We know here that perfection is nonsense and peace is a perspective shift away. And don't we need those lovely perspective shifts in the middle of being stuck at home every day? So at the top of the show, you heard my sister. She's got some fungus problems. There's a fungus among us. I couldn't help it. If you are in a place where you are needing some more oversharing from strangers, join us on Patreon. You get two additional shows a month and a private Facebook group. And it's a way to support the content that is here on Mom Struggling Well for you every single week. Go to patreon.com/momstrugglingwell. You can join for any amount and we would sure love it. Just this week, we have some new strugs over on Patreon. Marcy, Jennifer, Naomi, Laurel, Charity, Jessica, Monique, Tara, a Canadian Tara and an Australian Tara. We have a Jenny and a Jen. Ladies, welcome. Make sure you're in the Patreon group on Facebook. I can't wait to get to know you better there. So ladies, this week I'm bringing you a conversation I had with an author named Kate James. She wrote a book on a season of her life that was really difficult where she walked through drug abuse with her son. I wanted to talk to her because of that, but I also wanted to talk to her because she's very open about being bipolar and what is that like. And also you'll hear in the beginning she talked about how one of the first people here who got the coronavirus was her husband. And what's that been like to be quarantined at home and taking care of your husband when you're not a healthcare professional, you're a writer. So anyway, Kate has a lot going on in her life, but her faith and her deep confidence in the Lord is such an encouragement. And I cannot wait to share this chat with you. So let's go ahead and get started. Good morning, Kate. How's it going?
Okay. How are you?
I know. Such an interesting season we find ourselves in. But we'll start off by telling us a little bit about yourself. I purposely didn't want to do too much talking before we recorded because I just want to ask all my questions. And I don't know. Sometimes you have a whole great conversation before you start recording. Then you're like, oh, well, sorry, listener. You missed all the good stuff.
I know.
So tell us about yourself.
Well, let's see. My husband and I are in ministry, a college ministry, but now we run a publishing arm of that. So we're actually both writers.
Where do you live?
Right outside of Philadelphia. So west, about an hour west.
In West Philadelphia, born and raised?
No.
Oh, sorry.
No.
That's from the Fresh Prince. I couldn't help myself.
No. I grew up in the Chicago area and my husband grew up in New York.
Okay.
So kind of met in the middle and then moved out here. So,
all right. So you have how many kids?
We have three kids. Our oldest is married and in DC and they have one little boy. our middle is a girl. She's in, she's a woman now, not a girl. Actually, got to get used to that. she's in San Francisco. She's a video editor. And then our son is across town. He's married with a little baby. So he lives somewhat close.
That's nice. You're really kind of spread out everywhere, your family.
We are. Yeah, it's kind of the way I grew up and my husband, too. I think now it seems almost like generations are sticking around, maybe. I don't know. But a lot of my friends have their kids close by, but we don't. So it's kind of a shame. But it's, you know, except for our one in San Francisco, we can drive to see, you know, the others. So
tell me about what it's like to be a mom when your kids are all over the place and this virus is happening.
Yes, it's hard. This has really brought home the fact that we're not, you know, on the same farm in a little compound like they used to have, which I think would be wonderful now, you know?
I know.
All of a sudden, that sounds really, really good.
Well, and all the people who are in the same home with all their little kids are like, no, it's not as great as it seems.
You don't understand.
Get me off this compound.
My kids to the wall.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, no, it's been hard. Thankfully, we and are instigated by my wonderful firstborn daughter has, you know, had some family Zoom calls and things like that. So she's really good about getting us together anyway. Movie nights. Unfortunately, my husband has been quite sick, so we haven't participated in a lot of it. But yeah.
Tell me about that. Your husband has contracted the virus. Mm-hmm. When did that happen and how long ago?
He was like patient zero. I did not know how he ended up getting this thing. Wasn't around anybody who had traveled. Wasn't around anybody we knew had it. You know, of course, there's plenty in cities and stuff, but we're right outside the city. In fact, our county, he was probably maybe the third or fourth person to get it. And he was, you know, predisposed to get it bad. And he did. He has asthma and also some lung damage from bouts of pneumonia. So, yeah, he had the whole ground glass thing going on.
That's what I've heard, that's what it feels like when you breathe. Oh,
yeah. And they can see it in the they do a CAT scan and x-rays and stuff, and they can actually see it in there. They saw it before he actually had the positive test because that takes 5 days. So just knowing his, you know, lung history, you know, was really kind of scary. And he actually at a certain point said, I don't think I'm going to make it.
Oh my gosh.
Yes, it's really scary. It is very, very scary.
So how is he now?
He's doing so much better. I mean, I'm a nervous wreck because the way this thing works is you can do well and things head in the right direction. You feel like, okay, we're over it. And then all of a sudden, just very suddenly, we'll take a nosedive again. Okay. And so that was the fear, like a secondary infection or what have you. And it did happen a couple times. And so then I was kind of like, all right, I just can't relax because I have to always be on call. Plus, it's me taking care of him. I'm not a doctor. You know, I have one of these little things that you put on your finger, the oxygen thingy. I don't even know what it's called.
Yeah, pulse ox.
Thank you. So I'm supposed to take that and his temperature and trying to get him to drink. And so it's just a lot of pressure, you know, and when to take him to the ER. You know,
yes.
And, you know, tons of advice, texting advice and stuff like that. And you're kind of like, I don't know. Some people are saying take him to the ER. Some are saying not yet. And he has this added fear that really is kind of multiplied because of, you know, the media, too. And now I'm just terrified of like him not getting a ventilator. And I think a lot of other people are like, get him over now, you know, yeah. That kind of a thing. So anyway, it was just horrible, but he's definitely better. He is recovering well, and I cannot tell you how many people are praying, and we just absolutely know that had a lot to do with it. I mean, thousands. Like, it was one of those things where we had no idea. You know, I was actually in the parking lot at the ER. I had taken him. I can't go in. So basically dropping him off, he's scared. He has no idea what's going on, really. And I can't go in. I mean, I cannot go in the building.
They won't let you.
Mm-mm.
Okay.
Nah. So I just went back to the car and all I could do is just, I did Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And just said, please pray for my husband. And almost, I don't know when you hit that viral or what's called viral. I don't know. But anyway, there were so many people praying. I didn't even know. People in London, you know, people are telling me, like, I talked to somebody and they're like, I heard of that guy. I'm praying for him. And it's just so, you know, that really, it blew our minds. I mean, it blew our minds, God did. And also that people would care so much. So, and it's also made us all the more eager to use what we have as far as prayer, you know, and not to take that lightly.
Yeah, we think it's a last resort, and it isn't. It shouldn't be. It might be, but it shouldn't be.
Yeah, it isn't. And I think, well, I know I learned a lot of that because of my son. We had the same kind of thing happen. And, you know, just incredible coincidences, as this quotes, you know, air quotes right now, that happened that caused people to pray for him right when we needed it. So I knew enough to know the power of it and that this is nothing small and that this is something, for whatever reason, God chose to use for his own glory because he wants people to see that, hey, this is me, you know?
Yeah.
This is me. And, you know, I'm going to help the doctors. I'm going to, you know, all these things are going to fall into place because of me. And it also brings you to a place where it's like, if you have so many people praying, it's helpful too, because it's kind of like you can get to that place where even if he doesn't make it, you know, with so many people praying, you know, God's in control. That wouldn't make it any easier.
Yeah. He heard this request. He didn't miss it. He couldn't have.
I've heard this before.
So we know that technology has improved just about everything. Phones, cars, shopping, but mattresses, they've more or less been the same since the invention of sleep. But we deserve better. And finally, the mattress has evolved thanks to Purple. So the secret to Purple is the Purple Grid. It's a patented comfort technology that instantly adapts to your body's natural shape and sleep style. Purple is designed with open air channels and temperature neutral gel so that you never sleep too hot or too cold. It really is for every body. So I have had the opportunity to lay on one of these mattresses. We don't own one. My husband's obsessed with owning one soon. But they really are soft where you need it to be soft, but still firm. Very impressive. And Purple is so confident in what they do that every Purple mattress comes with free shipping and returns and a risk-free 100-night trial. You can use this mattress year after year because it's not going to sink or lose shape. Experience the next evolution of sleep. Go to purple.com/MSW and use promo code MSW. For a limited time, you're going to get $150 off any Purple mattress order of $1,500 or more. That's purple.com/MSW, promo code MSW, for $150 off any mattress order of $1,500 or more. Terms apply. So that's kind of your current moment. I also want to talk, though, you are open about being bipolar. Mm-hmm. And so mental health is kind of, it's for those of us who struggle with it, it's around all the time, every day. But when things like this happen, or we have a tragedy in our personal life, it really just kind of flares up in a way that it can be so intense and debilitating. I don't know. And then also on top of it, you are following Christ. And so we kind of, the message is that we kind of shouldn't have these problems, or they should at least be tied up in a pretty bow. And then then you feel like a failure. And then the enemy really, it's just a vicious cycle, and difficult is an understatement. So tell us about your mental health and I don't know, and your faith and what that looks like.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, I think a lot of, especially with bipolar and probably so many mental illnesses, they tend to kind of really become evident in, you know, your young adult years, like 20-ish, that kind of thing. So for me, it kind of coincided with having kids, you know, young kids. So it's kind of like a bad, it's a nightmare. You know, you already have all these insecurities about having children and this and that. And then you get depressed, really severely depressed on top of that. And I think, you know, a huge part of the depression is guilt. It just kind of goes hand in hand, right?
Yeah.
You just feel that way. You feel like you know you're capable of doing more. You feel this, just you're very capable. And you have ideas even about what could happen. But you just don't have the motivation and the drive, and so your hands are tied. It's a horrible place to be.
And it's dumb because they literally aren't tied, but you can't communicate how much they are tied. Like,
Exactly. I know. And so you just feel like you're lazy, you know? And it's hard. It's very, very hard.
I've described it as like you wake up a couple floors, you know, in the basement where everyone else gets to start on, you know, the ground floor, and you're like trying to come up from six floors below.
Exactly. That's so good. It's so good. And you know, your kids are young and you like, I wish I could be a homeroom mom, but just like, I can't.
The minute those emails come, I delete them. I don't even.
I'd have half the cupcakes done and then the poor other half of the kids wouldn't have any.
So, yeah.
So, you know, having young kids and learning to deal with that. And it was misdiagnosed as just regular depression. So I was on just a regular antidepressant that can actually make bipolar worse. So I was on that for probably 10 years until they realized it was bipolar. So.
Okay. So how did you realize that? And because I'm trying to think of, is the listeners like, I don't know, am I just sad or do I have something that I should go to the doctor about?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, a lot of people can go to their GP, their regular doctor, and they'll prescribe the antidepressant, and it's really helpful. And I think that's majority of people. But for me, it really didn't help. And I would have these times, especially of energy, where I would have like a lot of energy, and it didn't even necessarily mean I wasn't depressed, but I would have energy. So I would be doing kind of not crazy things, but crazy things. So,
Yeah.
Oh, just high creativity, building things like tree houses and stuff and using chainsaws and things I didn't know how to use. And I had no right to be using, you know, and then that would be sort of short lived and I'd still feel depressed. And eventually I think my depression just got bad enough where I went to see somebody who specialized in bipolar things and depression. And I took a long, extensive day long, like study tests and all that sort of thing. And then it came out as, you know, bipolar. There's two different types. You may have talked about this show before. So there's bipolar one, which would be the kind that, you know, you think you're amazing movie star or director or something. You run around and tell everybody that would be, and you think you might be God. Those would be bipolar one, you know, and that would be the manic stage where you really are delusional. And then bipolar two, which is what I have, would be much more subtle, where you just have a lot of creative energy. You can all of a sudden talk a lot more, that kind of thing. And also recently they're finding more and more that it's, and believing more and more that it's probably a spectrum. Which makes a lot of sense to me. And so you're on the spectrum, maybe, you know, more or less, and, you know, we're rhythmic people and, you know, it's very complicated, but they are finding out more and more. So
when you got that diagnosis, were you relieved or were you disappointed, embarrassed, or what? Did you feel seen for the first time? What was that like?
I was probably more relieved just to have a good diagnosis. I mean, everybody already knew I struggled with depression, and a lot of the struggle for me was with the kids because they were young and feeling like I wasn't doing a good enough, you know, or doing a good enough job, and finding out that I actually was bipolar explained a lot, you know, where I would have this energy and then, you know, kind of sink into this place where I couldn't even do anything anymore. And so it just explained so much.
Yeah.
It was clarifying and it just helped. It really did.
That's got to be even more confusing than general depression, because sometimes you do build a treehouse and sometimes you can't get out of bed. Whereas with depression, you kind of like would never even consider building a treehouse, maybe.
Yeah, it's true. It's really true. Yeah. And it is. In fact, Kay Jameson, have you ever heard of her? She's sort of the expert on bipolar illness. Okay. She's bipolar one. And my daughter read a book by her, and it was sort of a memoir kind of deal where she explains, you know, finding out that she was and everything. And my daughter actually came to me and I really held on to this. And she said, I think it was kind of fun.
Oh, having you as a mom?
Yeah, that there were parts of it anyway that were fun. There were parts of it where I was crazy and didn't do anybody any good for sure. But that she was able to kind of focus on that part that really was fun.
That's sweet.
We were very short lived and I could still feel depression. It's something called a mixed episode where you sort of feel both. It sounds really strange.
Interesting. Okay.
And then my downsides could be really, really bad.
Can you describe a bad episode just so if somebody's listening, they're like, okay, I can see myself in that.
Sure. Yeah. There is absolutely nothing that makes you interested in anything. You know, I see my friends wanting to go out to eat, go out to dinner, and I'm like, why? What could possibly make you want to do that or get out of bed and go someplace? I don't want to go out of the house. You know, I want to stare. You know, if I'm doing okay, I can read. It's just a horrible place to be. You feel completely trapped. And, you know, there's all these things you should be doing. It's kind of like everything turns into a should.
Mm.
You know, I should be doing this or should be doing that. And I don't know about other people, but I can start hoping in things. And my hope is probably because I've been on so many different types of medications and they've had to tweak them and this and that. And so I start putting my hope in, okay, you know, I try to figure it out in my own mind and sort of research because I have researched every medication there is on the face of the earth for depression. And so I can just get obsessed about that. You know, maybe if I take this, maybe I'm taking too much of this, if I tweak it or whatever. Because these days, I think a lot of psychiatrists really, and for a good reason, listen to, you know, their patients. They don't just say, hey, here you go. They want to, if you think this medication might be a good one to try, let's try it. That kind of a thing.
Having the patient's buy-in is a big deal because then they may actually take the meds.
Yeah.
Which is helpful.
It is.
Okay, so how do you reconcile this with a faith that says, be joyful always, pray continuously? Like, how do you, why is God not fixing it? Are you not trying hard enough?
Yeah. I think that what it is, I just define joy differently than, say, the world defines it. The world's joy is much more of a happiness, you know? Even being able to find joy in your grandkids, and to think that you can't on some days sounds blasphemous almost. You know, these are gifts from God. These are your quivers, you know?
Yeah.
And that you can't enjoy this obvious gift from God can feel blasphemous almost. Like, what is the matter with me? You know?
I think all the moms are nodding like, yes.
So, you know, the reality is the only place you can find it is in Scripture. Even if you feel nothing when you're reading Scripture. And yes. I think it's important to know that's not like, oh, it can easily turn into a thing where it's almost like if I open my Bible and I read a verse and everything's going to be okay and I'm finding my joy in the true joy, which is Christ, right?
Yeah.
So that sounds good. We know it's true, but we still don't feel anything. We're still depressed.
So what do you
do? That doesn't change the physical reality of who we are right now and our brain's not functioning properly.
So then we jump to beating ourselves up. Like, what am I doing wrong then?
Yeah, exactly. So it's just knowing that that's where the joy is, you know, that is be joyful in the Lord, knowing that that is where it is. And I'm not going to stop that. And I'm going to persevere no matter what, even if I feel nothing, you know, that's real faith, right? Faith isn't like, oh, I feel this strong desire to, you know, go and do these amazing things for God. Faith is stepping out when you feel nothing.
Yeah.
You know?
We think of the heroes of the faith, like Abraham. No, you'll have a kid. No kid came. Right. Like there's so many times that they don't ever get to see. The faith is just, believing in what you can't see. And it's building character and it's building endurance. And it really is beautiful. Mm-hmm. But the faithful working out of the keeping going back to Scripture when you could not care less if you tried.
Yeah.
It really is beautiful and it's faithful and it pleases the Lord, but it unblades us sometimes. It does not feel pleasing. Yeah.
Exactly. And I've kind of come to the conclusion at different times. If I feel something, then thanks God, that was awesome. But if I don't till the day I die, it's okay. You know?
That's good. And that's hard.
So hard.
That's so good though. I think honestly, there really is something beautiful about struggling with a mental illness because it's like walking through quicksand or walking through water, like trying to run down a lap pool. You're like, can't, it's just so hard to even do anything. But yeah, there's a beauty and a strength in that. And I know that the Lord is pleased when we continue to dig through the treasure for his word, not for the feelings it produces. But oh my gosh, it's so hard to get out of bed sometimes. Okay, so for a person who feels that the Lord should be able to fix our mental illness without medication, can you speak to before medical interventions and after, and your reasons for choosing to, I'm assuming you're medicated?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry, that sounds
bad. No, me too, sister. Hey.
Yeah, I think that before I was medicated, I just assumed that I was, that everybody was like me, that everybody kind of had this sense of like just really low grade depression all the time. And I'd had
dread.
Yeah. Like since I was a kid, never had lived without it, so much so that I didn't know any other way of being, you know. But then when I got older, it just became so profound that I kind of had to do something, because all of a sudden I could not do anything. And for me, it was very sudden. I remember exactly what I was doing. It was just all of a sudden I was feeling okay and kids were doing great. Wasn't anything bad happening. My husband was playing with them in the backyard. And just all of a sudden, it's like I couldn't move. Just everything stopped. So it's kind of where I just knew that I had to do something. So
yeah, I think I have clients sometimes who are like, they don't believe they're depressed because they feel like they're just being silly, you know, or making stuff up. And I'll ask them, like, why on earth would you make this up? Like, this is not fun. You're not enjoying this. And they're like, you're right. I'm not enjoying this. I'm like, then why would you make this up?
Yeah, it's true. Good point.
Yeah, no, this is not an enjoyable. No. So tell me about afterwards. What's different?
Yeah. Well, right away, they put me on some pretty strong stuff. So the side effects kicked in immediately. But after about 2 weeks, I felt, you know, kind of, wow, this is like the way that other people feel good, that this is, wow, there's actually places to feel good and that this is more normal. And so from there, it was like a lot of tweaking and things. And I wasn't on a good medication, but I didn't know it. But overall, just the fact that I had these sort of pockets of feeling good was sort of, yeah.
It gives you something to compare. This gives you a hope.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That's the tricky part, is the side effects come right away, but the actual good effects don't come for about 2 weeks.
I know. Yeah, it is. It's really, really hard.
That's tricky. Okay. Well, thank you for being so honest about that, because it's, I don't know, it's just still a taboo thing, unfortunately, especially in the Christian subculture. And I don't love it.
No, I don't love it at all. It really isn't. Thanks for what you do. I mean, for real, it's just perfect. I wish you were around when I was a kid.
Oh, gosh. You're so sweet. Did you know that only 19% of children's books showcase women with jobs or career ambitions? Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls podcast tells hundreds of bedtime stories about the lives of extraordinary women from the past and the present to inspire our little girls to pursue their dreams. Designed to close the confidence gap in young girls, these stories explore the talent and results of incredible women across every possible field, from trombonists to scientists. To inspire the rebel girl in your life, go and find Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls on your favorite podcast player. Have you ever felt like you have words to share, but you don't know where to start? Have you ever struggled with the tension between the art of writing and the business of publishing? With the help of Hope Writers, an online community of working writers dedicated to the success and creativity of each member, you can learn how to share your words of hope with a world that desperately needs to hear them. Hope Writers takes seriously the creative, social, and spiritual call to the deep work of sharing your stories and ideas with the people who need them most. They help writers make progress by finding and following the path to sharing their words with a reader without feeling lost, discouraged, or overwhelmed. To learn more and discover which of the 6 stages of writing you're currently in, visit hopewriters.com/MSW to take the 30-second quiz. You have words of hope. Hope Writers wants to help you share them. That's hopewriters.com/MSW. Now, I have to tell you, you wrote a book. It's called A Prayer for Orion. So I have a boy who is, he's 8 now. Okay. And he is the sweetest little boy I've ever met. And so the fact that you call this your son in here, sweet boy, I cried so much. And this book was so beautifully heart-wrenching and hopeful and like, oh my gosh, I love this book.
Oh, I'm so glad.
But it was so hard to read your story that I was like, I don't even know if I can talk to this lady without crying the whole time. But okay, so you have a son, and he gets into drugs, serious ones, and you have so many, I mean, just, you paint a picture of him being out and he calls you and you can tell he's high and like just the thought of your sweet kiddo growing up and doing these things that are life and death things and all you have is a phone line between you. I can't even imagine the panic. You didn't know where he was and all of these things. And so share a little bit about your story, because I think that for those of us who moms of young kids, this is like their biggest nightmare. And then as they get older and we let them have more freedom, there's a lot of moms listening who are dealing with this very exact thing.
Yeah. Well, first of all, you know, you definitely don't expect it. I think that your generation of moms are in such a better place than ours were. Really? I always like to start with that. Oh my gosh. Yes.
Because
yes,
how?
Yes. Writing the book, my biggest fear is that people will be discouraged or scared. And I know there's going to be some of the discouragement, but it's a different thing. Now, you guys have been educated, you know, for us, you know, my generation, when we had young kids, it was very much a situation of, you know, we were told and read books and things that if you do this, then this will happen. You know, you follow these rules by so-and-so family, whatever, whatever. And your kids are going to be okay. So the natural conclusion to that would be, if your kids aren't okay, it's because you didn't do this.
So as if we need outside guilt added.
I know, right? Exactly. So that was very much a part of it. And so that was something I kind of had to struggle with as well. And my buying into that wholeheartedly. It also opens up a lot of sort of floodgates as far as judging other people. Right. So, and I tell that, yeah, because their kids are off the rails or their kids aren't obeying, then it's because they didn't do this, this, and this, you know? And so as far as I could tell, I was doing this, this, and this, you know, and my husband was doing this, this, and this. However, our kid already, you know, didn't do well. So that's number one. And I feel like as your generation has really kind of taken to task some of these things and just you're far more real. I'm sure that you struggle with judging, but at the same time, you know enough not to. And I think that there's just more freedom to talk about it and more freedom to share stories. And these things help a lot. I didn't have a clue what I was doing. We didn't have a clue. And so we didn't know that certain things, we didn't know predisposed kids to doing drugs or to addictions.
Okay, so tell me, what are those things?
Okay, some of those things, I mean, it's crazy. Some of the things would be, you know, obviously any kind of mental illness or depression or that sort of thing. And then you get into things that you never would think are, like food phobias, you know? And my son was very weird about food. And, you know, at the time, of course, like I said, it was more like, well, you're not giving him enough different types of food, or you're not doing this, or you're not doing that. And instead of kind of alerting me to, okay, he's got these sensitivities and something's going on here, and let's just keep an eye on him and blah, blah, blah.
And so, just to connect those dots for people, the reason, my understanding, and you probably know more than me about this, but the reason that a sensitivity or a phobia or an anxiety can lead to, as they get older, drug abuse would be because they're trying to lower that anxiety. So I have a child who is on some medication for like a mood stabilizer. And I don't love my kid being medicated. However, I could see that this child was starting to change their view of themselves, and it was starting to impact their view of their identity because they were having a hard time with their mood. And so then people were responding to them in a certain way, and their grades were reflected in a certain way, and they had a lot more consequences than everyone else. And I could tell that they were saying, I am a bad person. And they were not old enough to say, there is something going on with my brain. And so for me, having them medicated, I'm able to see this child, you know, this child is flourishing and blooming, and it's beautiful. And they no longer believe that they are bad because they are more stable. And then hopefully, Lord willing, that will then translate into some coping mechanisms where they do not go on to use substances to make themselves not feel as bad.
Yeah.
Will that happen? Nobody knows except the Lord. This all could not work at all, but that is the thinking. So just that for a mom, so that's wise. Like, why is a food thing could turn into a substance abuse thing? I just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah, no, that's really just so good. And it's really wise what you just said, I think, as well, because you don't want to kind of just deepen these ruts that they're getting into when they start to struggle in different ways. And, you know, that doesn't mean that you don't wean them off, but it's really, really just so, so true. So,
it's one thing to say, oh, you were made in God's image and Psalm 139, together in your mother's womb, and all that stuff is true. But then if it's also like, and you're grounded for being such a jerk every day, like, which is it, you know? So just helping them manage.
Yeah. So true.
It's so complicated. Yeah. And now let's all be quarantined at home, so we have all the time together. Wow.
Some social scientist is going to have a heyday, man.
Seriously.
I mean, think about it, right? Books. Books will be written.
Yes.
Books will make money.
Yes. Okay, so tell me the story of, I don't know, just he got into substances, you blamed yourself.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like walking through that? Other than blaming yourself, like, practically, is there something that you would suggest to a mom? Or were there red flags that you didn't know were red flags at the moment?
Oh, gosh. See, that's such a huge question. And this took place over 5 years or so, all of the craziness. So it was hard because, you know, we all think never our kid, and kind of like your generation, I'm not sure you do this as much as we did, but
I'm the worst. I'm like, no, it's definitely my kid. So anyway, sorry, go ahead. That might be just my own problem.
It's kind of like, okay, wait, your kid did this to my kid. And, you know, it took me a while to realize, wait a second, my kid might have been the one selling marijuana. Mm-hmm. instead of so-and-so to him. So it's, kind of, that's the way you think. And that's the way that I always thought that he was the good kid. And, you know, because I knew his heart, because he is a good kid and his heart is so sweet, you know?
Yes.
And so just made us think that he would never lie to us, or he would never, you know, do anything like sell drugs. Not that he ever did. He actually didn't get into that. But, you know, it's just so mixed and so complicated. It's really hard to piece out, you know, exactly what we would have done differently or what caused him to go this direction, other than the fact that he was predisposed because of anxiety and some factors like that. But, you know, in the end, we did end up having a lot of kids around our house because we just have an open house, kind of just the way we are. And my husband's just kind of like that. He does a lot of speaking for students and stuff. And so it was an open house. We had a lot of kids around talking, and some kids came to Christ, really started growing. Just there was Bible studies here, that sort of thing. So long story short, some of his friends started walking with God and came to our son and told him to tell us what he was doing.
Wow.
So in many ways, actually, they literally saved his life eventually when he overdosed. But at that point, he told us what he was doing. And there was always something within our son that really did want to do what was right. You know, he was never, thankfully, kind of like, you know, F you. He was, at least to an extent, felt bad. I should say that felt bad that he was hurting us. Although I know it's not always the case. So
for sure. It's all, they're also, every case is so different as well.
Yeah. And some people just feel, some kids probably just feel so ashamed. They don't want to, you know, own up to it. So they just run, you know?
Yeah. So yeah, it sounds like you, quote unquote, did everything right. Having Bible studies in their house, your house, and all of that kind of stuff. In the midst of it, and I know it was a while ago, but in the midst of it, what did that do to your faith? What did it do to your marriage? Like, how do you be on a Tuesday afternoon at 2 p.m. when you know this is going on with someone you love so much?
Yeah. Just a constant level of anxiety, for sure. Sort of prayer became a constant thing for me. And letting other people I knew who I trusted to pray for specific things. And, you know, my emotions would go up and back down depending on what was happening. Literally, you know, if our son came home at night, then I'd be thankful. You know, if he didn't, I'd be terrified. So it really was just a yo-yo. It's like I was riding a yo-yo throughout this whole thing. And then constantly judging myself, you know, if only, or maybe we did this wrong, or we should do this. My husband, thankfully, wasn't like that. He doesn't look at what has been done because it's pointless, which he's right. You know, just looks ahead as far as what, you know, and prayerfully what should happen. Of course, in my mind, I'm like, well, you learn from your mistakes. So let's talk about that.
Yeah, they're both valuable.
But thankfully our marriage did okay through it, but I could see how that could potentially just really complicate things, you know, if you disagreed with the way you were handling it or if one of you didn't care or whatever. But you know, thankfully that wasn't the case.
Did this grow your faith? Was it like a strain on your faith?
Interestingly, it was the hardest strain on my faith as anything in my life has ever been, and it grew my faith more than anything in my life ever has. So yeah, there were times where I just couldn't believe that God could possibly be real because of what had just happened. One being, we thought that our son was doing really well, and kind of ended up having to knock down, my husband had to knock down his door, and we found him blue. And that was after I'd been thanking God all week for how well my son was doing. So I just, you know, you hear about people talk about the floor kind of dropping out from under you. It's exactly what it felt like. It felt like the floor literally had just dropped out from under me because I'd had faith for so long. This is how I stood up, and all of a sudden it wasn't there. And a miracle happened right then, because for whatever reason, my husband came over to me, looked me in the eye and said, "Don't worry, I'll believe for you." And that got me through that. That was and in the end, that strangely, I don't know how these things work, but it built my faith. Just strengthened me in the end, somehow. Just knowing that, yeah, I got through it.
Okay, so you thought he was doing great, and so you kind of let your guard down, you're praising the Lord, and, you know, they're dancing in the streets, and everything's amazing, and there's confetti, and then you find him blue, literally almost dead. How, mm-hmm. I mean, then you don't want to let your guard down anymore. Then he says he's doing good, and you say, yeah, right.
Right, exactly.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, and so then it was a matter of, okay, I have to come to a new level here of faith, because it's that or nothing, you know, and I don't want nothing. So I have to come to a new level of faith. And that's where it was. I have to trust that even if he dies, even if he overdoses again, that that I'm still going to be with my Savior, that everything will ultimately be okay, that I'm going to die well. Mm-hmm. And it comes to that, because what else do we really have? We don't know. So, yeah.
Gosh, I mean, wow. You think you've got a pretty solid level of faith, and then something happens and you're like, oh, that was just scratching the surface.
Apparently I didn't. Yeah.
How is your relationship different with him now, your son? I feel like I would want to like check in every couple of minutes. Like, so are you doing heroin now? Are you, you know, I don't know. I feel like I'd want a helicopter parent.
I know. It is tempting. And I probably did do a little bit of that originally. It's been quite a while now. It's been 7 years, 8 years. But yeah, that's definitely there for sure. I think it almost feels a little bit like it'll always be there. Just a sense of what if. And the thing is, what if things don't go well in his life? You know, that might be a trigger. So things don't go well in your life, you might sink into a depression. For our son, you know, he might start doing heroin. So that's the fear. But the more time that goes on, that fear is less and less there. And I really feel pretty free right now. My husband feels pretty free. And we have a good relationship. He's always been a pretty chill kid. So it's not like, you know, he's outgoing and, you know, all that. He's got a wonderful wife and a little baby. And he's attentive, very giving, you know, if we need help, that sort of thing. You know, he's good at what he does. He's in tech. So.
Okay. Did you have to have some forgiveness? Was there any bitterness or anger for what he put you through? Did you have to do any heart work in that way, or you're just relieved?
I think I'm just relieved, honestly. Okay. And after walking through the whole thing, I don't think that there's any sense of that he was, well, I know he wasn't trying to hurt us. I think that what helps with that with us is that he is, we know he's repentant. One of the things with drug addicts is that there's this use, shame, repeat thing that happens. So they'll use, they feel guilty, they feel terrible shame, and then that shame drives them to use again. And so the guilt is there, you know, and if you really think about what they're going through, even if they're rebellious about it, I think it helps. Of course, our son wasn't violent, you know, he never got terribly mean or anything, which helps a lot. If he had, I don't know, that might not be such an easy thing. When I wrote this book and when I finished it, I gave it to him to vet to make sure he was okay with everything in it. And he read, he came to me and he read the first couple chapters. He's like, Mom, I'm sorry, I can't keep reading. And then he said, I'm just so sorry I did this to you. And so, you know, that's that was his heart, which was really helpful that he was honest about that. I think a lot of kids would feel that way, but they wouldn't actually verbalize it, you know. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of sorrow and guilt and all of that for many, if not all, kids who get involved in these things.
Yeah.
But, you know, they might not say it, so.
Yeah. Was there a resource that helped you throughout this? I mean, other than the Bible, but what would you recommend for a mom going through this?
Yeah. I would recommend, first of all, getting involved in any kind of a prayer group that they can find for specifically kids who are struggling, not just any prayer group. I mean, that's good, but I think you need, you know, parents, and not just a parent group either. You don't want to, it's hard to be praying for somebody's kid who's, you know, getting a bad grade in science or something like that when you're on the street.
Yes. Yes.
So I would find a good group. There's something called Prayer for Prodigals. They're not everywhere, but something like that is really, really helpful. HopeForHurtingParents.com, believeit.com is a good one. It's got a lot of resources for parents in there, you know, and there's also an online prayer group, which I got involved with, where you post your kid, you post exactly what's going on, and then people pray for them specifically by name. So that was really, really helpful. As far as like books, I really actually liked something called Clean by David Sheff. Not a Christian, but it is very, very thorough as far as information about drug abuse of all different sorts and medications that are available. And it goes into some of the legal issues. And it's just really, really good. I learned a lot from it. And some of the positives and negatives about rehabs, good ones, bad ones, which is a thing. You know, rehabs make money.
They sure do.
So you get some people, some rehabs are great, others are terrible. So I really recommend that book as far as just the practicality stuff. Yeah, I mean, as far as getting through it, I feel like any book that just helps you stay close to God or walk closer with God is really helpful. There's a book called You Are Not Alone by Dina Yohi. That's a good one. It's just, you know, her daughter writes some in it, and it's basically just like a little devotional workbook, but it's just helpful knowing you're not alone. I mean, it's a very powerful thing. So, but I think their ministry is significant. Her and her husband did it. They have a daughter, Renee Yohi, who got into drugs, was on the street. Long story short, her, because of what happened with her, began to write love on her arms, if you've ever heard of that.
Yes, I have.
Yeah. So that's a pretty powerful ministry. But to write love on her arms is probably more, you know, it kind of expanded into other things, but You're Not Alone. Her parents kind of took on this struggle that parents can have.
I love that. That's so, so important. Thank you so much for sharing all this.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I wanted to ask you one more question just so we can end on something not as heavy. Mm-hmm. What's something you can't stop talking about these days?
Yes. Having just been, or actually being quarantined right now, and because of our sickness, COVID, we can't step outside our door, basically. And so friends have been dropping off meals. How do you say beef bourguignon? Do you know how to
say? Listen, you're the one who wrote it, and I had to look it up because I was like, I do not know. This lady is like Julia Child's fancy over here.
I am not, but yeah, no, I looked up how to spell it. I just didn't know how to say it.
Bourguignon.
Bourguignon? All right, that sounds right.
That's what the Google machine told me. So beef bourguignon.
This beef bourguignon that my friend dropped off on our front door is the most amazing thing in the world. Unbelievable. I have been holding off eating the whole thing because I think I might do it after we get off right now because I just want some so bad.
Yeah.
It is amazing.
It's like a noodles and beef. Does it have like a red wine in it? It sounds like.
Yeah, a little red wine. She made it with some mashed potatoes. I don't know how she did it. I'm going to find out. It is amazing.
Get that recipe. Will she tell you where she got it from?
Yeah, she'll tell me. She's good with stuff like that. So
that sounds amazing.
Oh, I love it.
Good. What a good friend.
Yeah, she's good.
I love it. Okay, Katie, thank you so much again.
Thank you.
We'll put a link where everybody can get your book. Get us on the yo-yo just that you're on as well. It is so beautifully written. So thank you for doing this. This is another way that parents know they're not alone.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. You are not alone.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you, Katie.
Thanks.
Okay. I hope that you are encouraged as I was. I love hearing from moms whose kiddos are grown because their perspective is so much better than mine. So what will your strategy be to struggle well based on what Kate said? I encourage you to pick one thing. Don't pick 9 things. Don't pick none things. Pick one thing. I would recommend getting her book, A Prayer for a Ryan. It's hard to read because it made me have all the feelings, but it's magnificently written, so much hope woven throughout it. So maybe you struggle well this week by realizing prayer is not a last resort. Maybe there's something, if you were to sit quietly with the Lord, you realize you've given up praying about because you either think it's impossible or you've prayed about it too much or he's not listening anyway. I would encourage you to open the communication up with him about it again. I feel like I've been saying it for years, but let yourself off the hook about the stuff that you just can't do. Do not try to do everything. You do not have to be the homeroom mom unless you want to be. And then amazing. Thank you for doing that. If you feel like you're struggling with your mental health, especially during this super weird season, please see a doctor. Please ask God to lead you to the right doctor, the right medication, if that's something that you need to do. And above and beyond all of that, ask him to teach you what he wants to teach you through this. But I promise, sometimes it just doesn't need to be as hard as it is when you're struggling with mental health stuff. I loved what Kate talked about when she realized through her bipolar, she just had to define joy differently than maybe the ways other people around her were doing it. Maybe you struggle well this week by persevering in reading scripture and spending time with the Lord and realizing like that is the sacrifice, is to keep going back even when you don't feel anything, because feeling something's not the point. I forget that myself, but just continuing to talk to him and think about him, and even when no feelings are attached, that's faith. That's what the heroes of our faith have done. If you read Hebrews, I'm pretty sure it's Hebrews 11. It talks about all the faithful people. I mean, obviously not all of them, but a portion of the faithful people that we know who've gone before us. And a lot of them never had answers. So if you don't have answers either, you're in good company. Maybe you struggle well this week by remembering and reminding yourself that parenting is not a formula. You can do everything quote unquote right to the best of your ability at the moment, and things could still go off the rails. Or you could kind of be a lame mom, which I'm not saying that you are, but some kids just turn out great because they decide they're going to turn out great. I mean, there's really no way to know. Also, when we want to give a side eye to a mom because we think their kids are acting terrible, it may not be the mom. The kid may be struggling. So I don't know. We just need to go ahead and give mercy. We need to give each other grace and be less judgy. I really liked what Kate said about how this trial with her son was a strain on her faith, but also, and in a mysterious way that we don't know how the Lord even works, it grew her faith. it's like lifting weights and how we are straining our muscles and yet at the same time we're growing them. So if you're really struggling right now, take heart because this is where the growth happens. And finally, if you are struggling in a particular kind of way with a certain issue with a spouse or yourself or a kiddo, maybe you struggle well this week by finding a specific support group for people who can understand that. And I get it. I know that when I was dealing with infertility, I didn't want to find an infertility support group because I didn't want to admit that I was dealing with infertility. It felt like surrendering and it felt like it made it too real. But I promise you, it would have been so helpful and I wish I would have done it. Ladies, go ahead and hit share and send this to someone who you think would benefit. Your recommendations about this show mean the world to me. Thank you so much for all the times that you share it. I see so many of them on social media and I appreciate it so, so much. Also, make sure you're subscribed because next week I'm going to be interviewing Rebecca Smith. I don't know if you know her, but no, of course you do. She's the host with me of The Problem Solved. We're going to talk about her new book, which, by the way, comes out this week. So go ahead and get that. It's called A Better Life, and we'll talk about it together next week. All right, let me pray for us. God, there was just no way around the fact that there are some really heartbreaking parts about this life. I praise you. I'm so thankful that this life is not all there is. Lord, in the midst of heartbreak and times of uncertainty where we're tempted to fear, would you just gently lead us on into endurance? God, help us to keep our eyes fixed on you so that we can encourage people around us. Because the fact is, we have a hope and we have a joy that this world doesn't have. God, would we look different? Would we not blend in? Lord, for moms who are struggling with kids with issues, mental health issues, addictions, would you give extra tenderness? Would you be extra present? Lord, thank you that you don't leave us in the midst of all of these really hard trials. And thank you, and we don't know how, but that you promise to work it all out for good. And we're going to hold you to that. But, you know, obviously, you never let us down, so we're actually not that worried. In Jesus' name, amen.